back to Textory. I don't know why whenever there is an audio description on, I think, Spotify, it turns Textory into Text 3, which makes me think I'm pronouncing it wrong, but then it's my name. I came up with it, so I know how to say it, right? I don't know. Anyway, welcome. Before we get into the text, as always, a reminder that I have a Patreon at patreon.com/textory if you want to support the podcast and make sure that future episodes are coming. Today, we are going to talk about the Polish city of Gdańsk. You see, here is the thing. It's Polish in modern day, but historically, it's been a hot mess. It was a place where cultures mashed and mixed and blended. But I think because of that hot mess and because its history is so intercultural, Gdańsk is just so fascinating. So obviously, Gdańsk is also known as Danzig, so the German name for the city. And from my understanding, because I was trying to sort of grasp the vast history of the city and what happened and which country it was based in for the longest time, and it's pretty confusing. So Gdańsk was a Polish city up until 1308. So ever since Poland was a thing, which is also quite fluid, and you know, we have some dates that we like to stick to, but it's actually very symbolic. So a lot of it is, oh, these areas were actually wild back then and we're not sure what was going on. So up until 1308, it was a Polish city. It was then taken by the Teutonic Order. Then in 1410, Teutonic Order was beat up by Poles at the Battle of Grunwald, and Gdańsk was Polish again. So then with some small episodes of chaos and war, Gdańsk remained in Polish hands for further 383 years, if my math is correct, until the 18th century partitions of Poland. So in 1794, basically the whole country went under. Prussia, Russia, and Austria-Hungary just took over. Each took chunks of the country, and Gdańsk became part of Prussia. So fast forward 123 years later, so quite a long time, but also given the whole history of Gdańsk, maybe not that long, Poland regains independence again, and things are not looking good, because Prussians are like, come on, it's been so long that this is practically ours, but then Poles are like, nah, we want Gdańsk back. So because of all the political turmoil after the First World War, Gdańsk was made into a free city. So basically neither Polish nor German. But it has to be said that at that point, the population of Gdańsk was mostly German after 123 years of basically occupying the land. So then the Second World War happened, and actually one of the first assaults on Poland happened in Gdańsk on the first day. Sadly, a lot of the city was destroyed during the war. And then literally half of the city was destroyed during the Battle of Gdańsk at the end of the war. So literally 90% of the old town was ruins. And what I find absolutely incredible is that walking through Gdańsk today, you would never be able to tell. Everything was rebuilt with such detail, and it has so many cute historical spots, beautiful historical buildings, pretty historical streets. And I think Gdańsk today really has this 17th century merchant city vibe to it. The tall buildings, the old crane, the artist's house ballroom. I just love it all so much. So every time I go to Gdańsk, I feel instantly transported to 17th century, back when it was the local hub of trade, basically. So today we're reading a real treat, because it's a part of, this is going to be long, Itinerarium Mundi. That is a memorial or sundry relations of certain voyages, journeys, etc. by Peter Mundi. Peter Mundi was a 17th century merchant. He traveled a lot. He was also a writer. So he traveled all across Europe, Middle East, and Asia. He actually first traveled to France with his father. Then he did Spain. Then he did Constantinople. Then he did India, to Japan, China. So he's seen a fair bit before going to Gdańsk. So this travel he conducted from 1640 to 1647, and it basically covered Amsterdam, some of the modern day Germany, and modern day Poland and Russia. But his base was Gdańsk, so he would be based there and sort of doing excursions from Gdańsk. So he did spend quite a lot of times in Gdańsk and the surrounding areas. And you may think, oh, so he probably just spent like at least a couple of months in Gdańsk, and then he just kept traveling to different places from there. But we tend to forget how freaking slow traveling used to be. Not only did you have to go by a horse or by a boat, but also so much depended on the weather. So if the weather's bad, that also means that the sea is bad, and then the roads are also bad because they're completely melted, and it's slowed down even further, which must be really annoying if you're the type of a person that likes to plan everything for the trip, but then, oh, you get held back for 2 days. So this guy actually spent around a decade of his life living in Gdańsk and then traveling to see the neighboring areas and neighboring countries. And then in 1663, he's like, you know what, I'm actually getting too old for this. And he retires in his native England. And that's when he writes all his memories down. Now, with all memoirs and diaries and written texts of all sorts, you always have to sort of take it with a grain of salt. And there is definitely some stuff that was exaggerated. There is some stuff that was likely made up. There is some stuff that he was probably told by someone that is actually not true. But also, surprisingly, a lot of the stuff that he's talking about is actually verified. And as someone who has read a couple of books on Gdańsk, the things that he describes were actually described by other historians as well. So that's how we know he's mostly legit. But obviously a lot of things are questionable. But let's get into it. So Danzig, so he obviously refers to it in the German name. Relation 33 of a voyage from Amsterdam unto Danzig in the Baltic Sea, with somewhat of Prussia, etc., countries adjoining. So that's the description of the whole journey. So everything that he's seen traveling to and from Gdańsk. We set sail from the Vlie, so from the modern-day Netherlands, with a fleet of about 240 sail. Those that were bound for Bergen in Norway parted from us as soon as we were out of the Vlie and clear of the sands. The 6th September, 1640. In the morning, the skipper, myself, and others in our boat went ashore. Passing by the castle, a large and strongly fortified place, we went about 2 miles up the river Weichsel. So he means Vistula, or Wisła in Polish. A lot of the names that he gives are completely off, because he heard something and then he wrote that word in English. So a lot of it is, it's just so hard to understand what he's even talking about. Which is but narrow. So we came to the city of Danzig, the land towards the sea, such as about Amsterdam, but towards the country higher. Danzig, its comparison with London. The city of Danzig is the province of Pomerola, reckoned under the crown of Poland, reckoned also in Prussia, and according to the computation formerly made between Amsterdam and London, this place with suburbs may contain as many people as London with its suburbs, and as many as Amsterdam. To be fair, I did check that, and I don't think that's true. I think it was a much smaller city, but it's still quite big by those standards. In healthy time, void of any contagion or noted sickness, there die in London about 200 persons, at Amsterdam about 100, and here about 50, somewhat more or less. It lies in the latitude of 54 degrees north. Very hard winters, although the colder and harder accompted, the better and wholesomer, and very hot some part of the summer. Streets and houses. It has some fair streets, as Langmarkt or Marketplace, Langgast, Jopengast, Bredegast, etc. I never know how many of these names are actually correct and how many are just something he heard and then wrote down thinking that's how it's spelled. In these are many fair lofty buildings of brick, outwardly adorned with paintings and windows, and inwardly costly and curious in house furniture, pictures, etc. The ceiling and sides of their rooms neatly painted in stories, etc. Many rich merchants, shopkeepers, etc. The younger sort, costly and proud in apparel, ceremonious and complimental in behavior. High feeding, for here is plenty of variety, as at their weddings. For the moderation whereof, as also their excess in apparel, there are this year, 1642, certain edicts and orders set forth in print by the Burgermeister and Council of the City. That is actually true. People in Gdańsk were known for dressing really well and really lavishly, so obviously they had to spoil the fun for them and implement some sumptuary laws that forbade people of lower standing to wear certain fabrics and certain decorations. I find it interesting that he spent so much time in Gdańsk, but then he describes the most random things. Like, he's not describing the general lifestyle of people in Gdańsk or what sort of shops they had or what sort of people were there, but more things that he found interesting, which is perhaps the more subjective way of describing your travels, and maybe it's actually the better way, but I just find it interesting because one of the things that he describes is the hangman's privileges. He has good means, house well furnished, among the rest some instruments appertaining to his office, as several burnished swords. For men of several qualities, as burgermeisters, ratsherrens, so councillors, burghers, so the citizens, etc., each have their own reserved for them when they deserve it. The gallows of a strange fashion, being four square, has eight timbers thwart for use, the supporters of brick, ladders with double steps, one for the delinquent, the other for the executioner. I did hear that the form of the gallows in Gdańsk was messed up, like it was just not the usual. but it was like a bigger construction. His means accrues to him partly so much ahead for those that suffer. Also by surgery or setting of joints or bones out of joint. But I think he mares more that way than he mends. So this is an interesting thing. Hangman was also one of the first places you would go to if you needed surgery. You wouldn't go to a physician, you would go to a hangman because he had the necessary equipment, which is absolutely gruesome, but also that was your guy. Recreations in Danzig. In winter, they used to ride in small sleds drawn with one horse, called yak sleds. Some say from the yak hunting, so-called. So yak means hunting in German, but it may rather be from yak, a swift sailing boat, so actually a hag boat. So he's speculating about the origin of the word yak sled. And actually there is a caption right next to this entry where it says he probably got it kind of right. There being a resemblance between the swift gliding of the one through the water and the other speedy sliding over the ice and snow. In these sleds commonly sit two persons, a man and a woman, a young man and a maid, etc. The men guiding, so ferry away 3 or 4 miles more or less over ice and snow, either by land to Heiligbrunn or Holywell, or to their olive, Sopot, etc. All of these places are in the neighborhood of Gdańsk. Or else by water on the ice on the Matlow. So this is Motława, a river in going through Gdańsk, and then the German name is Motlau, and then he writes it sort of anglicized, so it's all a bit of a mess. So he says that they used to take those sleds on those rivers, two places hereabouts. They go with great speed, each striving to outgo the other and to get for himself the swiftest paced nag, so a little horse. In summer, they ride a horseback or in coaches to the places aforesaid. At Heiligborn, I was trying to figure out what place that is in modern times. I actually can't find it. It's a pretty pleasant walk between the hills, woods, and groves of trees on each hand. Always green, winter and summer, being most part fir trees. They also use shooting exercise with crossbows at a full of wood set up on a very high pole, also with guns at marks. There being a place for that purpose with certain orders and fellowship, somewhat resembling the manner of our military garden in England. And then he mentions a Jimkerhof. Moreover, feasting and drinking at the Jimkerhof. It is a large, spacious, lofty room, well adorned with ancient paintings. Imagery, rarities, serving for public use and meetings, as one of their courts of justice at one end some days in the week, also in foul weather. So, sort of a multi-purpose building that was used for different things and different events. Moreover, in the said house are certain orders having a free brotherhood or company of the principal of the city, whereof some English and Scots, their names recorded in a book, admitting through friendship whom they think good. These at some days in the year hold frolic feasts, commonly at night, where is lusty cheer, good wine and beer, music of various sorts as organs, etc., and other wind instruments, viols and voices. Solemn and ceremonious healths round, all with civil mirth. I have a strange feeling that Peter Mundy enjoyed himself at the Jimkerhof a lot. Like, he was like, you know, the vibes are great, the people are great, but everyone is very civil and they're not over drinking. Note that in these parts, no laboring the ground for many months together by reason of frost and hard weather, nor no cattle feeding in the field, all housed and kept in stalls, feeding on dry meat as hay, straw, etc. A hard winter and long, as I am told, which I am now bound to see. So obviously for an Englishman, that was something new, that people for half of the year, basically, were not really working the field, neither tending to the animals because there was not much to do. They were just waiting for the cold months to pass. And that's something that I've been thinking a lot, because obviously people in the past were laboring incredibly hard physically in the field, like doing farming work. But then that was only a couple months, wasn't it? There were obviously seasons that required more work, such as the harvest, but what were they doing November till March? At the house where the English resort to divine service, which is chiefly sermons, in Danzig aforesaid, was a beast hung up by the heels, as tall and as big as a pretty horse. So I read it, I was like, oh my god, they had some sort of a monster, like what is he writing about? And then he says, it is called an elk, whereof the best buff is made somewhat resembling a deer, cloven-footed but shagged as a bear. This had no horns. So, is that his first time seeing a moose? Is that what I've just read? At Smeargrove, okay, this is an example of him messing up the names. So, he writes about a place called Smeargrove, which honestly sounds a bit English. And then the actual name was Smeargrube, which is not even close, my guy. He's spent so much time in Gdańsk and surrounding areas, and he never learned any German, or at least how to write it. Smeargrube used to be a place, a village, that in 19th century got covered by sand. So it's pretty crazy, but back in his time, it was still a village. So he went to Smeargrove. I, with others, went to the other side of the Nering, so a sand spit, about a mile over, where we came to the open Baltic Sea, not frozen. Here on this strand, as also most parts hereabout, is found, gathered, and gotten great store of yellow amber, which is cast forth by the sea and beaten ashore, chiefly in summer, there being small pieces thereof now among the sand and gravel. It is here called Bernstein, so actually Bernstein in German, to say fountain stone, conceived to be bred that way. What can I say? We do love our amber. There is actually a pretty cool amber museum in Gdańsk if you're ever around, but this is not the topic. Then he speaks about something that I have read about in other memoirs or books about Gdańsk, and it's about a visit of a person that nowadays we would describe them as a conjoined twins. But back then, obviously, we're talking 17th century, they were described as a monster. At my being here came to this place one Lazarus Coloretto, an Italian born at Genoa, who had a living, breathing child growing fast to his belly, somewhat on one side, having head, hands, feet, etc. of human shape, although disformed. A wonderful spectacle. This is a part that always gets me whenever I start to not really fantasize, but whenever I'm impressed by descriptions of the past and I'm like, wow, you know, the grandness of those buildings, the cheer and laughter in the inn, and then you're confronted with a brutal depiction of a disabled person, of someone that was outside the norm, and you're swiftly brought back to reality because it's always so awful. So this person, I have read about him. He had a conjoined twin that was positioned sort of around his belly. And he would then use a piece of cloth to hold the sibling up. Now, that conjoined twin, the other one, was severely disabled. He was in a vegetative state. So he didn't really move. He didn't really react to anything. He was making some sounds, and he was actively like eating, as in chewing and stuff, but it's kind of awful how people like that were not even treated as people back then. He was a monster growing from someone's belly, and we don't actually know how aware he was of his surroundings, but either way, in eras such as this, the only thing his brother could have done, and I don't think he even considered him his brother, like whatever name he had for it was probably just some sort of strange growth with a face. But his brother came up with a business idea and he was traveling the world showing off because people were really interested in all sort of strange medical situations in that era. That era was really big on dissecting things, on trying to figure out how something is made, how it happened. A lot of people in that time were curating their own curiosity cabinets or collections with strange specimens put in jars. So in general, that was probably the best thing he could have done to, you know, make a living in that situation. That's the way Peter Mundy describes it. He says, he had been formerly here, as also in England, Scotland, France, Spain, etc., and could speak all those languages. He went from hence up into Poland and from thence intended for Turkey. He came hither against the great Dominic fair. Here is a little backstory. So Gdańsk up to this day holds a massive Dominican fair, which is sort of like a city festival, and it's one of the oldest in Europe. What Peter Mundy wrote is, he said, the great Dominique fair, which is way off. But anyway, he said that the guy, the one with the conjoined twin, Lazarus Coloretto, he wanted to perform at the Dominican fair, but was forbidden to be seen by reason of hurt that might ensue to married women, especially their younger sort, through their too strong apprehension or imagination thereof. I think the belief back then was that seeing something so shocking could affect young mothers. Then he goes on to describe how people of Gdańsk looked and maybe behaved a little. And the annoying thing is, I don't know if it's my copy or if in general those illustrations are lost, but he describes illustrations that were not in the book. So it was only one illustration of two people, and then he goes on to describe a lot more examples, which I think are either lost or, again, my copy didn't have them. So if you do know about those illustrations existing, please do let me know. But for now, we're just going to get the descriptions, which kind of works because, you know, it's an audio podcast, there is no images. A Polish gentleman. They ordinarily have their heads shaven, leaving one lock, which comes from the crown of their head to the forepart, like a crest hanging forward, whereas the Turks have a lock which lies just on the crown. The Turks and Poles, as they are neighbors in countries, so are they near in habit. That's mostly due to Sarmatians. So Polish aristocracy was like, okay, we kind of need to reinvent ourselves. And around 16th, 17th century, they started dressing in their own style, which was mostly borrowed from the East. But that's where the lock of hair comes from. I actually didn't realize that the Turkish hair stayed on top of the head, whereas the Polish hair was sort of, there was a lock of hair falling forward. It looked awful, not gonna lie. There is no patriotic feelings I have that will forbid me from saying this. This was an awful trend. And then the second illustration is a Danziger Jungfer, so a Jungfer is a maid or damsel, beginning to dance with him, which is here extraordinarily used at their weddings. Although the dances are not so extraordinary, for what I could see or hear, that's a brutal read. Generally after the Polish manner, not so artificial and active as galliards and corantos with us, nor so full of pleasant passages and changes as our country dances. I have to give it to the English country dances. They're so much fun. However, very seemly and gentile. One great use that they make of these meetings is to give an opportunity to young men and maids to grow acquainted and to speak to one another, which otherwise is not so easy to be done. I mean, that was the same across all Western societies. Dancing and any party involving a dance was a great way to meet your peers, because otherwise there was too much going on socially to even be acquainted with people. Then the third illustration is a hajduk with a magierka or felt cap. These are a certain order of foot soldiers, somewhat to be compared with the Janissaries in Turkey. So he is describing a Polish hat that was in turn inspired by Hungarian hats. Another illustration, another Danziger Jungfer with a garland on her head, which they usually wear from the publication of the banns till they be married. So the publication of the banns is basically giving notice about the marriage. So the marriage is not done yet, but it sort of becomes official once you publish a notice about it. Then we have a married woman with a fur cap in winter and a muff. In summer with a hat, the younger sort. Then a man with a muff, which commonly is of a whole otter's skin, it being the custom for all sexes and ages to wear muffs. If you've ever been to Gdańsk or any seaside town in Poland and any of the Baltic countries, really, you will understand why they wore muffs, because it's so windy. It's just really, really windy. So it makes total sense to me that both men and women were sporting muffs at the time. A Polish gentlewoman with a short cloak and a cloth under her chin, with us termed a muffler. I didn't know that they called that type of cloth a muffler, which sounds a bit sexist, to be fair. A woman after the old Polish fashion, with such a great round ornament on their heads of beaver's hair, not of that soft wool on the womb like down, but of the hairs on his back, which are long, black, and shining. Older Polish women in that era, and younger women as well, definitely sported massive fur hats, so he's onto something. We have a couple of other descriptions, but because we don't really have illustrations to tell us what they were, we're gonna skip straight to a description of Gdańsk in, I would say, not very favorable words, but when you read the explanations of those words, it sounds a bit more, it makes a bit more sense. So this city exceeds in traffic, in plenty, in voluptuousness, in pride, and in arts. And then he explains each of those. For traffic, witness near 200,000 tons of corn, besides other commodities brought yearly down out of Poland hither and from hence transported, which has and does marvelously enrich the inhabitants. Now, I've checked that, and it's actually not 200,000 tons of corn that left Gdańsk every year or came in, so this is a bit exaggerated. I think it was actually less than a half of that, but they did exceed in trade. There was a lot of trade going on, and also the fees and the taxes that you had to pay being a merchant in Gdańsk were apparently ridiculous. Like, there was a lot of stuff that you had to pay, so that's probably how the city got rich. For plenty, he's describing the word plenty. See their markets, how they abound with flesh, fish, chase, wildfowl, fruits, herbs, roots, etc. Such store, such variety, and so cheap, as it exceeds all other places that I have yet seen. Their voluptuousness, manifested in their banquets, meals, which not only abounds, but also in their long sittings, especially at weddings, which is commonly 5, 6, and 7 hours at dinner, their drinking answerable by men, this within the city. Their winter and summer walks without the city by great and small, to Heiligbrunn or Holywell, Sopot, Templeburg, etc., and other places adjoining, where the resort is great and expense immoderate, especially in trouts, crayfish, etc. rarities, not without music, wine, and beer, and dancing in every corner. I have a feeling he was maybe a party animal, because he doesn't describe the negatives of having people be socially active. He doesn't describe all of the drunk people that were probably lying in their own vomit. He goes like, there is so much cheer and wine and beer and dancing in every corner, and everyone is having fun here. So I think for him, it was a huge benefit of living in a town like this. Then he describes their pride, which is interesting, because to him, the pride is chiefly in their apparel, not to be paralleled, especially by the younger sort, and of them, the female sex, in costly furs, sables, etc., satins, silks, rich stuffs, jewels, chains, rings of gold, and precious stones on their bodies, necks, arms, and fingers. Also, their stately buildings, adorned and furnished within with curious and costly household stuff, paintings, ceilings, etc. These with the former may lawfully be used with moderation and commendable, but here is only meant the excess and abuse. So he's going after the buildings looking well and not after people being dressed in gold? That's interesting. And lastly, for arts and sciences, their artificial clock tower and chimes, the best I have yet seen. The fountain before the Junkerhof, organs and musical instruments in which they exceed, music not so general in use in no part that I know. Their buildings and furniture, curious arts as painting, carving, dialing, so clockmaking, with all other necessary handicrafts not wanting. But more especially in one particular speculation or observation, whether commendable or no, I leave it to censure. he actually is talking about astronomy here. And then he goes on a whole talk about astronomy that I think we're going to have to skip because this episode is getting long and I don't really understand what he's talking about anyway. But he mentions astronomy as one of the fields in which Gdańsk and its citizens exceeded. And it's actually true because you may have heard of Hevelius, a famous 17th century astronomer who was also the counselor and chairman of the city of Gdańsk. And that was actually the same time period because in 1641, so around the same time as Peter Mundy was in Gdańsk, he built an observatory on the roofs of his three connected houses. And he has made a lot of discoveries, and actually so did his wife, Elizabeth, who obviously was ignored throughout most of history because she was a woman. But now, years, decades, centuries later, we can actually appreciate her astronomy work. And she is regarded as one of the first female astronomers that we know of. So pretty cool. Everything about Gdańsk is cool. I have to say, all of its history, all of its periods, everything is so, so interesting and so full of really strange but fascinating stories and really, really cool and really inventive people. It really seems like a sort of a place, at least in that period, that allowed people to live and think differently. And maybe that's why it seems to have such an impact still. So if you're ever around northern Poland, I really encourage you to visit Gdańsk. There is a lot of stuff to see. There is a lot of stuff to do. And they have fantastic fish and chips. So, but speaking still of Peter Mundy, I wonder if from all the places that he lived in, like what impression Gdańsk left on him and how it affected his later life. But I guess we'll never know. So for now, that's all we get. We get his fascinating diaries and memoirs. I have to say it was a mess to read because his spelling was messed up. I mean, 1640 is not that old. There is a lot of older texts that I thought were much more readable than this. I don't know what he did and why he spelled things that way, but almost every word was, it just seemed much older than it is. So I'm not sure what his problem was or if it was just a stylistic choice. No idea, but even Shakespeare is more intelligible than this. So this was tough, but I hope you enjoyed it anyway. As always, let me know what you thought and don't forget to check out my Patreon at patreon.com/texttree for some other texttree related and cool material. Thanks, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye!